History friends, patrons all, to Poland Is Not Yet Lost, episode 20. It's quite the milestone we've got here, the 20th episode. 20 episodes plus all those background episodes as well. And it's kind of hilarious to think that when I envisioned Poland Is Not Yet Lost all those years ago, I literally thought, okay, I can probably tell the story of Poland in the 18th century in about 30 episodes. Bit of a spoiler, we're about a fifth of the way through the century, and we're also about a fifth of the way through the episodes too. So if you're in this for the long haul, if you want to know what happened to Poland, don't worry, I am too. All those original plans have been abandoned, and as usual, I decided to just give in and tell the story of Poland in the detail it deserves. As long as the story remains so compelling, we'll continue to cover it. And another spoiler, the story only gets more and more compelling in the second half of this century. Back to our story at hand, though. Last time we started backtracking to cover what was called the Silent Sejm in a bit more depth, after several episodes of just passing references to it. In episode 19, the last episode, we established that the Silent Sejm was the end result of years of turmoil and agitation against the machinations of the King of Poland, Augustus II. The nobles and wealthier magnates in Poland suspected that their king harboured nefarious ambitions for establishing an absolutist hereditary dynasty in the Commonwealth, which would erase their freedoms and usher in a new age of restriction and authoritarianism. These fears, as we've already seen in previous episodes, compelled the Poles to do incredible things, such as rally against any attempt to forge an independent foreign policy, restrict the ability of the king to call on an army, and rely on neighbouring powers, such as the Russians, to guarantee its constitution against the schemes of their king. These developments reached their peak by 1720, with the abject failure of the Treaty of Vienna, something which we've hovered around for quite a while now, and the resulting reconciliation between the Russians and Augustus, the latter of which had attempted to tread a more independent foreign policy line in the years immediately after the Silent Sejm here. In this episode, we're going to go back to the Silent Sejm at long last, and we're going to see what it was all about, in an episode which has its fair share of surprises. I was first made aware of the Silent Sejm all the way back in summer 2012, if you can believe it, more than 8 years ago, when I covered the War of the Polish Succession for the very first time. Since then, my views on the event have changed, but even as recently as the 5 Weeks to Run Wild project in 2017, I made the mistake of parroting the same old view that the Silent Sejm was universally bad for the Commonwealth, and some of my Polish listeners justifiably let me know that there was a lot more to the event than that. With this in mind then, I hope you enjoy this episode, and I hope that in the case of my very valued Polish listeners and supporters, you feel I did the event justice. For everyone else, let's begin as I take you to February 1717. After so many years of conflict, tempers and tensions in the Commonwealth of Poland-Lithuania were understandably high. Since the outbreak of the 1648 Khmelnytsky Uprising in the Ukraine, the Commonwealth had never been the same. Revolts of once loyal and reliable vassals to the Polish crown were combined with opportunistic interventions launched by Sweden and Russia, and wars with the Ottomans in particular also helped to ravage the Commonwealth and destroy the ability of Warsaw to properly administer its very lands. This destruction of central authority and the weakness of the government after so many costly wars, particularly in the latter half of the 17th century, was exacerbated by the increase in power and activity of the smaller regional assemblies where local nobles and powerful magnates alike gathered. These assemblies were called semyiki, or in the singular, semyik, and it helps to see them as miniature sejms. We're not going to get into too many terms in this series. As you know, Polish is by no means on any plane of reality a language that I speak, so I'm going to try and avoid these terms where possible. But it does help to use the term sejm for the big national parliament, or semyiki when you're referring to the several miniature assemblies that are in the regional areas. And of course, any pronunciations, do correct them for me, because otherwise I'll just carry on regardless. In the previous centuries, these regional assemblies, the semyiki, would be beholden to the central government in Warsaw. They wouldn't be able to convene without the permission of the king. These prerogatives of the government were fundamentally eroded, though, as the 17th century progressed, with the result that by the turn of the century, these disparate regional semyikis were running the Commonwealth and controlling its policy. In some of the more built-up areas, these semyikis even had their own ambassadors, and they were controlled by some of the wealthiest of the magnates who would represent their interests to foreign powers as though they were independent states. And in a sense, they kind of were, because there was no way for the beleaguered Commonwealth, or in other words, the central government of Poland, to reverse this trend and challenge the strength of the regional semyikis. Certainly not when the Republic was assaulted from all sides during the Great Northern War, and civil war raged during its early years. When Augustus returned to the Polish crown in 1709, though, and when the Confederation of Sandomierz sorted out their affairs during a short Sejm in spring 1710, it seemed like one of the major aims of those present was to attempt to roll back the clock, to centralise the Commonwealth by removing the powers of the semyiki, curbing the influence of the magnates, bringing the hetmans back into line, and generally trying to stop Poland from turning into what looked very much like a decentralised federal state. All of these aims were punctuated by the goal to establish a permanent tax base. This tax base would fund a standing army, which would be controlled and directed by the king and his ministers in the central government. At the same time as ambitions for centralising the country progressed, the opposite side of the argument put it that by centralising the Commonwealth, the notables of the country were placing the independence of the nobility in jeopardy. If the king had a standing army, if he was able to reduce the power of the semyiki and bring the military hetmans into line, what was to stop him removing other limits to his powers and establishing an absolute monarchy in the Commonwealth? Against these fears, the king and those in favour of reform argued that a change was desperately needed if the Commonwealth was to keep pace with his rivals and heal its gaping wounds. In addition, the concerned nobles were assured Augustus had no intention to abolish the elective monarchy or its sacred constitutional traditions, so there was no need to fear this change. Such reassurance was all well and good, but King Augustus was infuriatingly boorish when it came to personally assuring his subjects that he had no pretensions to absolutism or to curb their individual freedoms. A wiser monarch would have discerned that the issue was a sensitive one, and he would have treaded carefully, but as we've seen in the last 19 episodes, Augustus was anything but in tune or sensitive. He proceeded carelessly, bringing in his Saxon countrymen in increasingly large numbers, as his subjects became more and more spooked. Resenting the limitations on his own powers and the stubbornness of the magnates, Augustus refused to meet the disaffected nobles, who felt compelled to form the Confederation of Tarnograd in retaliation. Eventually, this confederation, or you might want to just think of it as a little miniature rebellion, was brought to heel, and both sides determined to settle their differences through negotiation. In the backdrop of a heavy Russian presence, a treaty was signed to be confirmed and debated in the Sejm, due to convene on the 1st of February, 1717. Those who gathered on the 1st of February, 1717, could have cut the tension with a knife, since they had after all sought to attack the other faction present in the building only a few months before. It was plain that the Russian Tsar wished to have some kind of say in what went down. Ever since the war between the Confederation of Tarnograd and Augustus broke out in November 1715, so a year and a half before basically, Russian soldiers had entered the country and lived off the land with impunity, ignoring calls to leave and presenting their position as that of a concerned, neutral party. Tsar Peter, it is true, did not want the Commonwealth to disintegrate into chaos as a war with Sweden needed to be fought, and Russia really did need the Commonwealth and the Saxon Elector as firm allies against the growing hostility of the Holy Roman Emperor and George of Britain Hanover. Saying that, though, it's also fair to discern a level of opportunistic cynicism in Peter's actions. It was no accident that Russian soldiers refused to leave. By remaining present, they aimed to force a decision upon the Commonwealth and ensure that the conflict between the king and his subjects was forcibly ended. As is always the case with national histories, the accepted interpretation of events has come to be reassessed by revisionist historians, and in his article on the impact of the Battle of Poltava on the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Remember, the Battle of Poltava was when Tsar Peter effectively trounced the forces of King Charles XII of Sweden, and King Charles XII made his entry into a Ottoman vacation. But historian Robert Frost assessed the conclusions of such analyses, writing that much of the revisionist case rests on a reassessment of the work of the Sandomierz Confederation, whose existence from 1704 to 1717 made it by far the longest-lasting confederation in Polish-Lithuanian history. On another account of the genesis and development of the Tarnogrod Confederation, and in particular on a more positive interpretation of the same that challenges the view still entrenched in popular histories that the settlement it endorsed was dictated by the Russians as a means of dominating the Commonwealth. Historians have demonstrated that much in the traditional view is myth. Thanks to Robert Frost for trying to clarify some things, but I feel this extract raises more questions than it answers. If the Russians were not able to enforce any kind of settlement, and if the traditional view is not entirely accurate, then how does it explain how the Commonwealth experience of the 18th century played out after 1717. In other words, if the silent same is not the capitulation to Russian imperialism which is so often portrayed as, then how come the Commonwealth virtually ceased to pursue an independent policy in the years that followed? As a matter of fact, we have learned in previous episodes that this was largely untrue, and this is why I'm coming to the silent same now after covering the years that followed it, so you can kind of see what I mean a bit better. The Commonwealth was occupied by Russian soldiers, for sure, but under the pressure of both the Sejm and foreign potentates like George I, the Russian soldiers were forced to bow and evacuated the Commonwealth by 1720. In addition to this, the silent Sejm did not mean the end of an independent Polish foreign policy. We have seen how both Augustus and Commonwealth statesmen made a sincere effort to pursue their own policy in between 1718 to 1720, when the Treaty of Vienna was repeatedly up for debate, and both the Holy Roman Emperor and George I made several representations to the Poles directly in an effort to get them to join the alliance. If you'll remember those previous episodes where we covered the Treaty of Vienna, that alliance was said to depend upon the acquiescence of the Commonwealth if it was to succeed, and for a time it seemed as though Augustus was about to lead the Republic into a predominantly anti-Russian policy, with Britain, Hanover, and the Holy Roman Emperor as his allies, with room for more powers including Denmark, the Dutch, and Sweden, who could also join. Perhaps the sole reason this independent policy didn't pan out was due to Augustus, or, more accurately, the nobility of Poland not trusting Augustus after the events of the recent civil wars which had led up to the Silent Sejm in 1717. Much like Augustus so disconcerted his subjects that they rose against him, the Saxon elector also failed to use the necessary tact and sensibility when approaching the Treaty of Vienna issue. Augustus should have made efforts to discredit the rumours that he aimed at absolutism in the Commonwealth, but instead he announced the conversion of his son to Catholicism and his marriage to the Holy Roman Emperor's daughter. Augustus would not give up his dynastic ambitions for the Polish crown, which to the Commonwealth notables looked increasingly close to absolutism. Understanding that Augustus had a somewhat difficult time dispelling the rumours of his absolutist pretensions in the past, the Russian delegation to the Sejms over 1718 to 1720 were eventually able to make use of scaremongering and conjecture, and Augustus's own errors, to intimidate the Commonwealth's nobility into deadlock. With the Russian soldiers absent, the immediate foreign danger had vanished, and the original issue which had united king and nobility seemed to vanish with it. So the nobility would not approve of any of Augustus's schemes, because underneath the public aims of the Treaty of Vienna, they saw, or at least they thought they saw, the nefarious desire to install his family as authoritarian dictators at the expense of the Commonwealth's traditional freedoms. You're probably well sick at this point of hearing just how much the Commonwealth feared absolutism, as much as I am sick of saying how Augustus squandered several opportunities to make good his position domestically and that of the Commonwealth in the concert of Europe because he consistently failed to perceive the degree to which his subjects feared his intentions. Or perhaps he did perceive their fears and he believed he was simply above them. Either way, it's not hard to blame King Augustus for what followed in the events of 1718 to 21, especially when we consider what might have been and we imagine what would have befallen the Commonwealth if it had only sided with the Treaty of Vienna from 1720 onwards, thus snubbing Russia and welcoming Western protection and approval. The Commonwealth was still important enough in 1718, the year after it had supposedly capitulated to the Russians, to be considered the key to the Treaty of Vienna, but by 1720, only 2 years later, after having let down the Holy Roman Emperor and George I so many times, both of these actors were compelled to see the Commonwealth, mostly in the way that we would now see it, as a pawn of Russian policy by this point, and helplessly hampered by this influence in European affairs. Having learned their lessons, neither the Emperor nor George I were likely to rely on the Commonwealth again, and it is for that reason that I consider the failure of the Commonwealth to adhere to the Treaty of Vienna in 1720, rather than the silent same of 1717, as the real nail in the coffin of the Commonwealth's prospects for independent action or sovereignty. By 1720, indeed, Peter had taken full advantage of the fearful imaginations of the Commonwealth nobles with respect to their king, as much as he had taken advantage of his supreme military position in light of his looming victory in the Great Northern War. The confirmation that his nobles were more fearful for their positions than they were dedicated to their stately duties served as a lesson to Augustus of the futility in attempting to further the Commonwealth's prospects. By 1721, having reconciled himself with his old friend the Tsar, and having watched the Russian domination put down stronger roots in Poland, King Augustus seemed to have abandoned altogether any ambitions for bettering the Commonwealth in Europe, and he set his sights instead on the succession for his son. Throughout the 1720s, his son's succession would pretty much dominate his activities. So it's for all these reasons that I've chosen to examine the silent same after everything else we've already covered. In light of what we now know about the Commonwealth's experience up to 1721, it makes sense to see the silent same in a different light as well. In actual fact, if we look at what was actually agreed to on the 1st of February 1717, then objectively, the silent same reads more like a reforming initiative than a capitulation to foreign power. Among other high-minded aims, those present in the same in 1717 agreed to reduce and restrict the powers of the Seimiki, which as we saw was a critical step towards the centralization of the Commonwealth. In the aftermath of the 1716 Civil War, the Confederates assembled at the same the following year were perhaps more willing to compromise and hand greater powers over to the king in the name of the common good, though this sense of goodwill began to evaporate in the years that followed, as we know, as Augustus blundered his way through several opportunities to reconcile himself with his nobles and basically just reassure them that he wasn't trying to turn Poland into an absolutist monarchy. Taxes were approved in this same in 1717, so Augustus could enjoy a permanent standing army which was no longer dependent upon the individual inclinations of the hetmans, the Seimikis, or the powerful magnates. It must be emphasized that these developments and decisions were absolutely crucial if the Commonwealth was to stand the test of time. In return for the commitment to raise a standing army under the king's command, Augustus promised to eject the Saxon army, which would assuage the nobility's fears. The issue of Augustus's private Saxon army had always been a hot topic in noble circles, and with the Saxons marching out of the country, it seemed possible that king and nobility would be reconciled. Cast as a confederated or pacification same, the practice of liberum veto did not apply in this case, meaning that it took only 6 hours for everything to be debated and approved over the course of the 1st of February. Since much of that debated and agreed to had already been raised and conceded in the previous peace treaty in November, which brought basically the king and his nobles to the peace table in the first place, it was largely a matter of confirming what had already been approved. In the presence of all the elected and eligible nobles, the same here had the power to grant legitimacy to the peace between the king and his subjects, and all understood what was at stake. Augustus's powers were greatly curbed, as the experiences of the last few years brought a new resolution to the day's debates. The king, so the same requested, was to be forbidden from launching any offensive wars without the consent of the nobility in the same first, and those assembled were also to be more informed of Augustus's foreign policy line before it was diligently pursued. If we fast forward a few years, again to the Treaty of Vienna, one of the major objections that the nobility came to have to that treaty was that Augustus, in his capacity as Elector of Saxony, had approved the treaty, and then simply expected the same, and all of Poland, basically, to approve it as well, without having previously conferred with them about its contents. This fact, that the Treaty of Vienna was negotiated independently of the Commonwealth's nobles, and thus potentially hid harmful or nefarious articles, was a fear of nobility emphasized in the years after the Treaty of Vienna came to light. The Tsar, informed of the silent Sejm's decisions here, was able to pose as the concerned bystander and ask the subsequent Sejms how it could be that their king had once pledged to keep them informed, but less than 3 years later went against this commitment with the Treaty of Vienna. Stirring the pot, as he was wont to do in Poland, Tsar Peter would get far greater mileage out of Augustus's failures to abide by the Silent Sejm's decisions than he would out of directly influencing the Silent Sejm's proceedings. The subsequent Russian domination is often underlined as beginning at the Silent Sejm in February 1717, and the gradual capitulation of the Commonwealth in the years that followed is explained away by the Russian advantages gained within this Sejm. What actually happened was that the Russians looked on mostly unable to influence proceedings, only to make a big show of standing up for the Sejm's promises once Augustus inevitably went against them. If the Russians had been in total control of the Sejm in February 1717, as is traditionally suggested, then there would never have been a provision inserted within the Sejm's deliberations to see that those Russian soldiers evacuated the Commonwealth as they had promised. This article had been placed there by the Confederates of Tarnograd, that group of nobles who had only finished fighting against their king the previous November in 1716, mainly because the Russian occupation concerned lands under the control of these nobles, and they had come to see the Russian presence as a grave threat to the Commonwealth's independence. Additional articles of the Silent Sejm also ruled that Protestant churches were no longer to be built, and that the army was to be billeted on lands owned by the crown to save the income of the magnates for taxation purposes, and that Augustus was prevented from imprisoning any citizens of the Commonwealth merely through his whims. The army was to be supported by state taxation and supplied by the king's own lands, and it was to stand at 24,000 men. It is thus possible to see the Silent Sejm as a highly ambitious, desperately needed, and sensibly debated gathering of the Commonwealth's nobles, wherein the major points brought up by the Warsaw Treaty of November 1716, which had brought the Confederation of Tarnograd and the king to the peace table in the first place, were confirmed. And the historian Robert Frost echoed these points when he noted that, according to the revisionists, the importance of the Warsaw Treaty, as confirmed by the Silent Sejm, rests on the fact that, for all its shortcomings, it was the only major item of reform to emerge from the Saxon era. Its achievement was to make significant progress with regard to a series of reforms that had bedeviled the Commonwealth since the Khmelnytsky Uprising of 1648. Of particular importance were its military and physical clauses. The revisionists point to the abrupt halting of the decentralist tendencies that had run rampant since the 1660s. The year 1717 represented a shock to magnate self-rule, since by depriving the same Yiki of many of the physical powers that they had taken upon themselves, in part as a result of the increasing financial paralysis of the central government, it marked the end of the period known to Polish historians as government by Semyiki. Enacting reforms that had been discussed for years, the treaty for the first time established a permanent standing army, whose financing was not dependent, as in the past, on the Sejm, but was instead guaranteed by permanent taxes. Finally, the substantial powers of the hetmans, which had earned them personal fortunes during the war, were reduced considerably, confirming a decision originally taken all the way back in 1710. One historian, Robert Butterwick, went even further than Robert Frost, though, and he wrote that the Silent Sejm is of fundamental significance through its definition of the principles of the personal union between Poland, Lithuania, and Saxony. It can be compared to the Act of Settlement in England, or to the provisions defining Habsburg rule in Hungary. The Commonwealth prohibited Saxon officials from deciding on Polish matters, determined that documents affecting the Polish crown had to be signed on Polish territory, and restricted the length of time the king could stay in Saxony. The king was forbidden to deploy Saxon forces on the Commonwealth's territory. The ruler became the only element linking Saxony and the Commonwealth of the two nations, and in each country he wielded authority consistent with his respective prerogatives. We must bear in mind that this contract between king and nobility, while it proved impossible in the long run to maintain or respect, was viewed in 1717 as the end of the series of conflicts which had really plagued the Commonwealth since the Cossack uprising in 1648. It had been a long road to get there, but those assembled on the 1st of February 1717 believed that their homeland was about to turn a corner. It wasn't merely the natives of the Commonwealth that believed this to be so. The Russian ambassador to the Sejm also echoed this view, saying that he had never seen in Poland a king so mighty and full of authority as at this Sejm. He was like a sovereign. The Prussian envoy to the Sejm went even further, exclaiming that a splendid basis has been laid for absolute rule. The king has lost nothing by the departure of the Saxon troops, since the Polish and Lithuanian army, or at least their finest troops, have been handed over to him. Furthermore, points of the agreement give him advantages such as none of the Polish had enjoyed since Sigismund II. How do we explain the claims of historians, then, that in the light of such high-minded and well-intentioned reforms, that the Russians were there to enforce the peace, and that Peter was named as guarantor of the agreements, ensuring that in the future he would have a right to intervene in Commonwealth affairs if he so wished? More than one account depicts the Russians and their Tsar as the guarantors of the Silent Sejm, and paint this guarantee as the beginning of the end in Polish sovereignty. For the sake of fairness, I should reveal these sources to you too, so that you can get both sides of the argument. In his book Disorderly Liberty, The Polish Culture of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth in the 18th Century, the historian Jerzy Lukowski noted that seduced by a senseless love of independence, the Poles came to equate license with liberty. The decisions of the Silent Sejm of 1717, imposed by Russia, confirmed the Liberum Veto, and fixing the army at a notional strength of 24,000 men, were a monument to our insouciance, shame and destruction in the minds of those present. Perhaps the most famous chronicle of Poland in the English language, that by Norman Davies, is equally damning of the event, when he wrote that the Tsar undertook to guarantee the agreement in the form of a written constitution, which really meant, according to Davies, that the Tsar henceforth could legally interfere in Polish affairs at will. In the mind of Robert Frost, though, this explanation is too simple, as he wrote, Norman Davies was wrong to assert that the Tsar became the guarantor of the peace, thus giving Russia a right to intervene in the Commonwealth's internal affairs. While Peter undoubtedly wished to exploit the situation to this end, and he certainly presented himself as the defender of magnate liberties against the king, both sides flatly rejected his offer to stand as guarantor. They may have invited him to mediate, but few had any illusions about Russian intentions. It was from the basis of his guarantee of the agreement of the Silent Sejm that the Tsar would later justify his intervention in the Commonwealth. And as you can see, there is some confusion over whether he did or did not guarantee it at all. To me, it makes sense in the atmosphere of the era that the Tsar did not guarantee the Silent Sejm, because there was already much opposition to Russia's presence within the Commonwealth from the Confederation of Tarnograd, and one of the most important rulings, which Norman Davies doesn't mention, legally obliged the Russians to evacuate the Commonwealth. What Tsar would approve a ruling which compelled him to remove his victorious army from the lands of a vulnerable power, which Poland certainly was at this point? Tsar Peter's subsequent behaviour and heel-dragging when it came to removing his soldiers suggests that he had no part in this article, so it can be surmised that he had no part in approving or guaranteeing the same in February 1717 either, except insofar as he was relieved to see conflict in the Commonwealth finally come to an end, since at this point in history he still needed Augustus's full attentions in another campaign against that stubborn Swedish king, Charles XII. It's worth addressing even the name of the Silent Sejm as well. One would be justified in asking why, if the event was not the simple spectacle of an enforced pro-Russian agreement, wherein no Commonwealth potentate present voiced his opposition in light of the overbearing Russian presence, why has the term Silent Sejm remained so enduring? And if I disagree with the idea that the Russians basically enforced all of this, why have I kept on calling it the Silent Sejm? This is a good question, but I'm afraid the answer isn't all that exciting. Simply put, there is debate over precisely how silent the February 1717 Sejm was, as there is additional debate over how great a presence the Russians were able to impose on proceedings. One historian has noted that several Polish notables at this Sejm were actually given the opportunity to speak, but that the Archbishop of Gniezno stormed out of the Sejm owing to the perceived limitations on his personal liberty. The major reason why the Sejm of the 1st of February 1717 has been presented as silent is because fewer individuals spoke at it than was normal. To explain why that was the case, we need to remember that the Sejm met in the immediate aftermath of a civil war, and with a resumption of conflict threatening to erupt again if matters were not dealt with, it's entirely possible that in these circumstances that it was the fear of conflict and the pressing need to ratify the previously agreed upon tenets of the November 1716 Warsaw Treaty, rather than fear of the Russians necessarily, that sped up the process and bypassed the traditional protocols. Thus, fewer people had an opportunity to speak, thus some people might have seen this as negative and so given it the negative name of Silent Sejm. If those present found this unpalatable and contrary to their personal traditional liberties, they knew better than to loudly oppose it, considering what was believed to be at stake. After all, don't forget, this Sejm was not an ordinary Sejm. It was what was called a confederated Sejm, and this meant that the proceedings were immune to the use of the liberum veto. Under these circumstances, many notables may well have not bothered to speak at all if they would not be expected to halt proceedings as they normally would have. Such possibilities open up to us when we consider that the Sejm's participants were not held in an undignified fear of the Russians, as the traditional narrative suggests. If the Russians were not to blame, then it is necessary to look elsewhere for an explanation, and sometimes the simplest explanation is the most likely. The Sejm may well have been silent, but it was voluntarily so, because there was nothing really to say. All of this is drawing me towards the conclusion that the Silent Sejm, and I'm going to keep on calling it that just because it's easier, was not an open and shut historical case. What it actually was depends on one's view of the entire event, but in my opinion, considering the high hopes and intentions of both sides, I believe it's possible to see the Silent Sejm as a precedent which established several lofty goals for the Commonwealth to achieve. The ultimate tragedy of the entire process, and because we know what happened in just a few years' time, the reason why the Silent Sejm is looked upon so negatively today is because these goals were in many senses too lofty to possibly succeed. The commitment to centralise the Commonwealth, reduce the powers of the Hetmans, for example, led to a quest to compensate these same Hetmans so that they would agree, and how else would they be compensated except by doubling their salary to over 200,000 zloty a year, a decision which alone swallowed 5% of the Crown's budget, a budget which was never very high to begin with. Worse omens followed, as these same Hetmans rallied against the Crown desperately for the next few years in a bid to get their old privileges and independence back, so that they would be responsible for raising soldiers again. But wouldn't you just know it, in the course of this agitation, they never tried to give back their inflated salary. In a perfect example of Augustus's cluelessness and the volatility of the situation, the Hetmans were outraged and took their case to the Sejm repeatedly over the next few years, when it was learned that this new Commonwealth state army would be commanded by the king's favourite Saxon, one Jakob Heinrich von Fleming. Incidentally, von Fleming was the Saxon official responsible for negotiating the Saxon commitment to the Treaty of Vienna in 1719, and his efforts to make the Commonwealth follow suit likely failed in large part because he was seen as a specific example of the king breaking his oaths as laid down in the Silent Sejm. Augustus was not meant to mix his Saxon and Commonwealth departments together, and the Republic's army was meant to act as an independent arm of the state, but it took the king no time at all to appoint his Saxon favourite to this army, and then to negotiate a treaty with this same Saxon behind the same's back. Once negotiated, the appearance of von Fleming before the Sejm and his appeals for the Commonwealth to join the Treaty of Vienna must have seemed like a cruel joke, but they were just one of a legion of examples that Augustus had already given of his unwillingness or inability to abide by, yeah, his own promises. Having used a Saxon official to do his bidding yet again, it didn't seem too far a leap for the same to imagine that he would do so again in the years that followed. And after 1719, as we saw, the same hardened in its opposition to the king. So, to summarise, in this episode we've concluded that the Silent Sejm was not all bad, and that it contained several admirable and necessary proposals for reversing the downward spiral of government and authority in the Commonwealth, which had to be addressed. For a fleeting few hours on the 1st of February 1717, the king and his people seemed united on several points, yet as soon as they exited the building, the objections and suspicions yet again began to pile up. While the evacuation of Russian soldiers from the Commonwealth in spring 1719 seemed to be a victory of the Silent Sejm's deliberations, in time this evacuation proved to be a curse, because the removal of the thing that basically united the Commonwealth and its nobles and its king together led to further infighting, suspicion, and offended feelings. Perhaps if it had been another king more sensitive to the fears of his nobility and more in tune with its old traditions, we could be talking about how the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth managed to traverse its woes and emerge on top. It's easy to forget that one of the main reasons why Tsar Peter sent his soldiers into the Commonwealth in early 1716 was because he wanted to kick the Poles while they were down, out of a Russian fear of a Polish resurgence, which could well result if Augustus and his subjects managed to sort themselves out. By remaining near to the struggle at all times, Tsar Peter ensured that he would be well positioned to influence events, and through this manipulation of the Commonwealth's notables, bring about in 1720 what he had wanted to do in 1717, guarantee the Russian domination of the Commonwealth. By holding out the carrot of succession to Augustus, as much as he held out the carrot of freedom to the nobles, Tsar Peter was able to play both sides with really tragic ease. The sheer weight of suspicion and fear after so many years of failed agreements and broken promises, it seemed, were simply too much. Next time, after covering this Silent Sejm, we're going to resume our story of the Commonwealth in 1721, having examined all that Poland-Lithuania endured up to that point. I hope this time you guys will feel I did a better job covering the Silent Sejm's events, and I hope you didn't get lost with the different terms that I dropped on you guys. As you can see, there is a lot of contention and debate surrounding the event, even today, with one side claiming that the Russian protectorate essentially began from 1717, and another claiming that the Silent Sejm, far from a capitulation, was a final, ultimately doomed attempt to resuscitate the Commonwealth before it was too late. If you would like to join the debate and weigh in on this yourself, you know where to find us. But perhaps because of the way history has panned out and the way current politics are right now, these things are always going to be contentious, so long as Russia is so large and surrounded by smaller states. Until then though, my name is Zach, and you've been with us for the 20th episode of Poland Is Not Yet Lost. Thanks so much for listening here, and especially for supporting this show on Patreon at the $5 level or above. It means so much to me, guys, and it's really helped me get through these difficult times and, yes, expensive times. I couldn't do this PhD without you, and on behalf of myself and my wife, thanks so much for listening, and I'll be seeing you all soon.